Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the One Stop English podcast. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host, Sam Wadsworth, former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Patrick Curry, Delta qualified teacher and editor on One Stop English.
Hi Sam.
Becca Sanderson, former teacher and editor of numerous business and general English titles.
Hello.
And Phil Painter, Delta qualified teacher and teacher trainer at St Giles International, London Central.
Hello.
This month we'll be discussing why learning styles are a myth, how not to end text messages, the cult of celebrity in ELT, and inductive and deductive learning. We also have an interview with Nicola Prentice, award-winning author, voracious blogger, and staunch advocate of equal rights in ELT. So, how is everyone? Are you enjoying the cold weather here in London?
Oh, yes, bracing stuff.
Yeah, wrapping up wood.
A little bit cold, isn't it?
Not so much fun for running outside, I'll say that.
I can imagine, yeah. Okay, let's get started. Becca, you've been reading up on neuromyths in education.
I have, Sam. Neuromyth number one, we only use 10% of our brain power, something Albert Einstein never said and is completely untrue. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Okay, neuromyth number two, right brain versus left brain, and the belief that if you are left-brained, you are practical and rational, and that if you are right-brained, you are...
Impractical and irrational.
No, it's artistic, isn't it?
Thank you, Sam. Yes, creative, intuitive. Anyway, again, that's untrue, another myth. But the neuromyth I thought we could talk about today is learning styles. And this is the idea that people can learn things more easily if they are presented in a way which matches their specific learning style. And, you know, there are many, many styles, but the top three are categorised as, anyone?
Visual?
Yep.
Auditory?
Yes, auditory.
Kinesthetic.
Yeah, kinesthetic, the top three. Yes, so I remember going to a presentation many years ago in Japan where this idea was introduced to us all, and we were all asked to kind of categorise ourselves. And the speaker asked us to remember the last time we had to build an item of flat pack furniture. And so if we used the pictures in the instruction manual, we were visual learners. And if we needed someone else to read them out to us, we were auditory learners. And then if we chucked the manual in the bin even before we'd even started and just got stuck in, we were kinesthetic learners. So on the back of that, I happily classed myself as a visual learner. That's what I was. And we all thought that was great. Simple as that. How about you guys? Do any of you classify yourselves in any of those ways?
Yeah, I think probably visual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Same for me.
Visual too.
Yeah, I used to draw a lot of pictures in class, so I guess that I would be a visual.
Yeah, I think that comes
teacher.
Up as a popular one. Okay, well, just a bit of background. The concept came about in the early 80s and is derived mainly from Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence hypothesis. Now, hypothesis is the key word here because, and I'm quoting psychologist and professor Josh Cuevas from the University of North Georgia, he says that multiple intelligences have gone largely untested and psychologists and neuroscientists generally have not come to accept the model. There is no evidence to be found. Cuevas also writes about a report which was published in 2009 by a group of psychologists, and we can put their names in the show notes if you're interested, where they identified the type of evidence needed to confirm the learning styles hypothesis. They then searched for relevant scientific studies which could actually test and support the existence of learning styles, but they found nothing, and any evidence they did find was apparently weak and unconvincing. But the interesting thing is, despite all the evidence to the contrary, learning styles are still hugely popular. There was a recent survey of school teachers from around the globe, and 96% believed in the idea of learning styles. And, you know, it's a big business. There's an entire industry based around this concept. There's, you know, conferences and seminars and books and workshops and so on. And, you know, a lot of money is being made off the back of this. So, yeah, what's interesting to me is why is it still so popular and pervasive? You know, is this one of those post-truth things that, you know, it doesn't really matter about the facts, but, it feels right? I just thought that's quite an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's comforting for teachers to be able to put students into particular categories. Mm-hmm. So everything's quite ordered rather than chaotic.
So, Phil, why do you think so many people believe this?
Well, I think students want to think of themselves as individuals, don't they? You know, different to the other people in the class. And maybe they look at their strengths and feel that they lie in particular areas and that's the way they feel comfortable learning.
Yeah, and I think just generally in the classroom, teachers want to help their students, and this is probably a way they think they can help their students and tailor things to suit their needs. I think with younger learners, perhaps parents are happy to know that their teachers are doing this and they're supporting their children's sort of individual learning needs. And perhaps once you start doing that, it's quite difficult to come out of that cycle.
But I guess from what you're saying, the evidence just doesn't back that up.
Yeah, I mean, I read something the other day, an article by a guy called Christian Jarrett. I just think it's quite an interesting point. He says that it's more comforting to people's ego to think that a class was difficult because of a style that didn't suit me rather than because, you know, I wasn't concentrating or, you know, maybe I just wasn't motivated enough that day. It's a bit of an emotional crutch, perhaps. But what are the alternatives? Well, studies show that the most effective way to learn is not about learning styles, but it's more about presenting the activity in the best possible way. So have you ever come across the term dual coding?
Yeah.
You have? Yeah. I hadn't, but apparently it's about how we remember things. So there are two ways to transfer information into memory, and that's verbal associations and visual imagery. And so if you activate both of those during the learning process, then, like, for example, you could combine different activities like passive study and drawing. But then if you combine those, then you'll increase the chances of actually remembering information. Yeah, so it's very interesting. And the debate is still open on dual coding, but it is an actual theory. So it's been tested as opposed to a hypothesis, which hasn't. And there is a lot of support behind it. You know, whether or not dual coding can supersede learning styles remains to be seen. But I mean, reading up on all of this has been a real eye opener for me, because I was completely sold on learning styles, and you know, clearly I wasn't alone. So I think the moral to the story is to keep yourself informed and don't believe everything you hear at conferences.
All right, let's move on. Patrick, I understand that young people today are quite picky about their punctuation.
Yeah, this is a funny little story I came across in Wired magazine that says that to the younger generations nowadays, ending a text message with a full stop is actually considered rude.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's quite weird, huh? But the article was based on a study conducted at Binghamton University in America. Participants in the study were asked to read a series of text messages. In some messages, responses ended with a full stop, and in others, they didn't. When questioned about their feelings, participants said that those messages that ended without a full stop were considered to be more sincere than those that did, which is a bit weird. Mm. However, the same response did not apply to handwritten messages, indicating that this rule is for online communication only.
But this is just one study, right? It's not.
No, it's not. ELT stalwart David Crystal backed this study up, saying that the full stop may well be coming to a full stop, if you will. Text messages tend to be short and sweet, and as such, it's clear that a sentence has come to an end, so why bother using a full stop? According to Crystal, the use of a full stop can actually connote different emotions, such as insincerity, sarcasm, or even aggression. And it's likely that in the future, in text messages at least, full stops will cease to be used. The example Crystal provides is, if you prepared a lovely meal for your other half and then he or she cancelled by text at the last minute, you might reply, fine, without a full stop, to show you got the message. But to indicate annoyance, you would in fact add a full stop. Okay. The lack of full stop would show acceptance or even acquiescence on the part of the sender.
Okay, so how does this apply to the classroom?
Excellent question. That's what I was wondering. Should we really be teaching punctuation rules for different forms of communication? And by extension, should text speak be taught in classrooms? Phil?
Well, in terms of text speak, yeah, I think it can be a fun thing to do. Mm. I do wonder how quickly it might get dated. Mm. So that's one concern. And also how much of it would be useful between non-native speakers, how much course books, for example, assume that there is some communication with native speakers in doing that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as always, lots of questions and, of course, not that many answers, at least not ones ending with a full stop.
So, listeners, what do you think? Is it time we ditched learning styles in favour of dual coding? Do you use perfect punctuation in your text messages? Email your comments to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. All right, next up, we've got Warmer of the Month. Each episode, we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun, communicative activity in no more than five steps. So, Phil, over to you.
Okay, so I've chosen a visual warmer for this edition of the podcast. So I've taken a picture, I've cut it up into different sections, and I'm going to reveal each section to you one at a time. And at each stage, you're going to tell me what you can see and then what you think could be, might be, maybe in the rest of the picture.
Okay,
so should we start with the first?
First one, bit of a window.
Some brickwork around the window.
Brick wall.
Yeah, I can see brickwork.
Could be part of a house, maybe.
So it could be part of a house, new building, old building?
It could be a building site.
Okay. Old building.
Old, I think,
All right, second part comes here.
Okay, some children, three children.
They look like a street urchins.
They're definitely children,
aren't they? They're queuing, aren't they?
Kind of underneath the window.
They look
they're all facing the same direction.
A little bit unkempt.
Maybe waiting.
Kids.
Yeah, maybe at a school, in a schoolyard.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. If you were my students, I might encourage you to use the modal verbs more, things like perhaps or maybe.
Oh, okay, nice.
Okay.
As well.
Okay, we can do that.
We'll just go through.
Okay, that guy's pointing at something.
Okay, so there's a guy at the front, for the listeners, there's a guy at the front of the queue now, a small child at the front of the queue, pointing up.
Is he pointing or is he holding something?
He's holding something in his other hand.
What's he holding?
I'm not sure.
It might be a rifle. It looks like a rifle.
I thought it might be a gun.
There, yeah.
He has, okay, he's got a gun.
Okay.
And he's looking up.
He's got a gun, everyone.
Okay.
Might be a distractor.
Okay.
I'm going through this at a much quicker pace than I would do with the students incidentally.
Okay, so in front of the line of children, there's an old guy.
He's wearing a flat cap.
Yeah, and he's talking to another little person.
Maybe he's selling something. I don't know what
he is selling something.
I don't think they're at school anymore.
Is cash exchanging hands here?
It is. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Have a look at this stick that's down here because that is quite.
Is he the old guy's holding the stick?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
What do you think could be on the stick?
On the stick.
What could be on the stick?
Candy floss? I don't know.
It could be candy floss. Maybe. Yeah, it might be candy floss.
I don't know, I just thought it was a walking stick. But it could be a net, maybe?
Okay.
Fishing net.
Anything else?
Oh, I feel like there must be something else.
Yeah, what is it?
Okay, let's show you the next bit.
Oh, it's balloons.
He's got balloons.
He's got a big load of balloons on the end of his stick.
And he's giving one to the little boy, and all the children are waiting for their balloon.
And are they waiting to shoot the balloons? Because there's a child with a rifle.
Oh, yes.
They're not waiting to shoot the balloons. On the right-hand side of the picture, there's the last part. It's a kind of story, if you like. So what would complete the story on the right-hand side of the picture?
So
is it like a fair and there's a stand and they have to shoot things and then they get a balloon if...
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah, maybe.
Mm.
Okay.
Anything else? Any ideas?
No. Know, what else could you do with the balloons? They're buying balloons, and one of them has a gun.
Don't be too distracted by the gun.
I can't stop looking at it. It's
okay. Let me show you.
Is this the last one?
Because it's the very last one.
What's
going on? Just explain, Becca, what you can see on the right hand side there.
What's going on? The little boys are all taking. There's lots of children flying away in the air. Holding the balloons.
Holding their balloons, that's right. Yes.
Okay.
So just to explain something I couldn't say earlier, this cartoon is called The Child Hater by Randall Searle. I think this works very well because there's a kind of story to it. There's a kind of progression.
Yeah.
I like working with cartoons because you very often find that you've got a single image where there's a story within them.
Yeah, I see it.
And would you use this with predominantly young learners, or could you...
No, I've used this mostly with adults, actually. Mm. I think it's particularly good. We mentioned the practice of the modal verbs and other things like maybe, perhaps. But also I've done this after working on describing appearance, so vocabulary for appearance. Mm.
Okay, yeah. So you can get a lot of vocabulary.
A lot. I've done half an hour with this. I've called it a warmer, but...
Right.
Yeah, I've done anything from 5 minutes to 30 minutes I've done on this particular one before.
Brent, thanks very much. Let's move on to Word of the Month. Each month, we discuss a piece of ELT jargon and how it affects teachers. So, Patrick, what can you tell us about inductive and deductive learning?
I can tell you that these are two distinct and opposing instructional approaches. In a deductive classroom, the teacher introduces and explains concepts to students. Students then complete tasks to practice the concepts, and this is a very teacher-centered approach. In an inductive approach, it's much more student-centered and makes use of a strategy known as noticing. Instead of explaining a given concept and following this explanation with examples, the teacher presents students with many examples showing how the concept is used, The idea is for the students to notice through the examples how the concept works. Mm-hmm. So it's basically inductive and deductive. Both approaches have various merits. Phil, have you used them and what advantages do you think they have?
I have used both of them, yeah. I think the thing that we need to remember about inductive learning, it can be a lot more time consuming for the teachers to prepare the lessons. Then again, you could argue that it's much more memorable for the students.
Very much so, very much so. Sam, any thoughts on deductive?
Well, actually, I was going to say that I've used both of them in class and that I don't think we should think of them as mutually exclusive, right? We can use both of them in class. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they're both good methods. Definitely. I think they're both useful in different contexts, depends on the situation.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Phil there. The inductive approaches do aid memorization because students are performing the task themselves, so it's much more memorable. But they're also potentially frustrating if the learners are used to a deductive approach from their own country. So those are our words of the month, inductive and deductive learning.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Okay, let's move on to this month's interview. This month, Patrick is talking to Nicola Prentice about gender imbalance in ELT, the cult of big name authors, and how to prep for a conversation class.
Nicola, hi there. How are you?
Hi, good. Thanks. How are you?
Very good, thanks. Thank you for taking the time to come and speak to us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's get straight into things. Can you tell us a little bit about the issue of gender imbalance in ELT?
Well, I particularly looked at it in terms of conferences. So, because I mean, that's a very big question. And you might say that a profession that's, I don't know, at least 60% women and probably higher doesn't have any gender imbalance. Because when you start asking questions like, where are the women in ELT, which was the title of a conference talk that I did at IATF a couple of years ago with Russ Main, the answer is like they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they are, but they're not in certain positions, like conference plenaries are still at least 55% male, and some conferences are still 100% male lineups for their plenaries. So, and I think that when people start talking about, like, who are the experts, who are the authorities, who are the gurus, that the list is always male majority in people's minds. So that's the kind of imbalance that I'm talking about.
What kind of ways could this imbalance be addressed?
Well, for the conference thing, which is probably the most obvious component of it, then I think you can say that women should put themselves forward, but that means applying to give talks at conferences, which women do, but they can't make themselves be invited to give a plenary, because that's either that they are sent by their publisher or the conference invites them. Mm-hmm. And so I think the only way that one's going to change is if, I don't know, all the usual faces said no for a year, and then those spots would have to go to women.
Yeah. Do you actually know of anyone who's done this, anyone who's turned down a plenary spot?
I know two people that have raised it. So one of them, I won't say their names in case they don't want that to be said, but one of them was asked to do a UK conference, and he said, well, is there going to be a woman as well? And they said, we've only got the budget for one speaker. So that put him in a bit of a difficult spot, but he did do it. And then the next year they had two speakers, one male and one female. So I think that was probably connected to the question that he'd asked. And then I know somebody else that was supposed to be in a forum, which means at IATF, or which means that there are four talks all are related to the same topic. They're short talks and they're kind of grouped together. He turned it down because he didn't really feel comfortable with it. And in the end, the conference organisers came back and said, look, you know, on balance, everything is equal, but just not this particular event. And they were choosing from talks that had been proposed, and they didn't have any more women, and the field was tech. So the question there is, like, why are there not so many women in the tech field of ELT? And so I think he has been going to do it, but he needs to be very publicly, I think, saying, look, I'm doing this, but I'm doing this and I want to raise awareness of the fact that, you know, there should be more women up here, and what can we do to make sure that there are. The rest of them, I don't think they do turn it down, though. I think they say, oh, I need to pay my mortgage. I can't turn down work, as if women don't have the same situation. And then they say, but I do support the fair list. And I think they think that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, you recently wrote an article for One Stop English, and this pertains to this gender imbalance as well. But in the article, you stated that when 500 people were surveyed and asked to think of big names within ELT, and nine of the top 10 names turned out to be men. In fact, 17 of the top 20.
Yeah.
So why is this, and what else can be done about it outside of conferences as well?
I think historically, a lot of those big names were established quite a long time ago when things were not as balanced. And so, you know, they deserve to be where they are, but things haven't changed enough that other people have been able to come up behind them. But the other thing, I think, the reason that we automatically, all of us, men and women, think of our authority figures as male is because it's been bred into us culturally. And until we start admitting that, we're not going to be able to realise that we have this automatic bias. Because if you look around at cartoon characters, superheroes, even cereal mascots, breakfast cereal mascots, chefs, it's all men. Mm. And so we're growing up at the currency, that isn't it, in the UK, we've got one of our notes got a woman on it or something like that. It's everywhere we look, children's stories full of male characters, and even the animals are usually male. It's absolutely unbelievable. So we're being just indoctrinated all the time to think of men first when we want an authority for something. I think that's why.
Absolutely. And in ELT, as you said, there are, in the classroom at least, there are, well, it's a 50-50 split really of men and women. So it would be good to be an industry that leads a change where more women are given an opportunity to speak at conferences.
Yeah, I mean, I think they do have that opportunity, but I think it's that they might not necessarily be as keen to take it up because they don't think that they're qualified or able to do it, whereas men are more likely to be not thinking about whether they can do it and just thinking about whether they want to. And, you know, there are things for which you are invited, and those invitations are not necessarily going to women as much as they're going to men.
Mm-hmm. Now, back in 2013, you wrote a blog post titled The Cult of Celebrity in ELT, which we touched upon before, and you described having a manuscript proposal passed over in favour of a big-name author without mentioning any names. Can you tell us a little bit about this issue and what you'd like to see change in the future?
Well, 3 years is actually quite a long time, so my thoughts about that have changed quite a lot. The idea that, like, the big names are taking all the work, I think, is changing because a lot of the publishers are using author teams now. So no one is writing a whole course book in the way that they can really make that impression on it. And I've stopped when I've been asked for proposals. I don't do those anymore because I used to think that publishers were interested in new ideas. And now I realise that actually they've just got a lot of people carrying out sort of increasingly vague instructions, trying to deliver something that no one really knows if the students want that or not. And I think, you know, I've got my own ideas about syllabus and speaking tasks. And I think that the way for me to get those written is to self-publish, which is kind of what I've been doing. But, you know, that said, I have written a book for Collins where a lot of my ideas kind of made it in, and they weren't bothered about like how big the name of it was. But that's not a course book. But I'm not sure that the industry works like that anymore with course books. And I've had some other kind of insights into how that whole thing works, is that I think sometimes the name you see on the front of the book isn't the person that wrote it.
Okay.
I was approached by a big name, a man, once to co-write a book with him. And he said, you know, he had all these ideas and he would look up his notes and he would send me the thing. And what he sent me was a one-page Word document. It was a list of chapter titles with words like history, family, and I thought, oh, okay, I see who's going to do the writing in this co-writing task. So I wonder how much more of that goes on.
Right, okay. Well, speaking of books, one book you've written is about speaking classes, in fact, and this is obviously a very popular area of English. Can you tell us three things that you recommend a new teacher do when prepping for a conversation class?
Yeah, well, the first thing is you can make it really easy for yourself by not having to do that much preparation, and that's kind of method that I outline, where you have your text, your reading text, as an inspiration, but you don't start with the students reading the text. That's the key thing, because that speaking lesson then becomes a reading lesson, and then they start asking about the vocabulary. You've wasted half an hour, nobody's spoken. So that's the thing. You do the speaking first about the topics raised in the text, and then maybe they read it later. And I also think people have, especially newer teachers, maybe they kind of want to jazz things up by having a taboo topic in class. And I don't think that's necessary, because most people will not publicly go against whatever the prescribed view is in their culture. And more innocuous topics probably cause more actual debate. My most controversial class ever was talking about, it was a throwaway comment by somebody about the fact that their dog was a member of their family. They considered it to be. And, you know, that generated an hour of debate.
Yeah, I think when it comes to dogs and cats, people do have quite strong opinions, don't they?
Yeah. Food is another one. Relationships is another one. You know, you don't need to go very far, I don't think, and talk about human rights and things like that, which everybody will say the same thing on anyway.
Yeah. So everyone has an opinion on a more generic topic, pretty much. Okay.
Definitely.
And for the coming year, coming back to the conferences, do you have any plans for speaking at conferences in 2017?
Big plans, actually. It's not been officially announced yet, but it probably will have been by the time you actually run this podcast. So I'm going to be running a pre-conference event alongside another woman.
Brilliant.
And it's about issues relating to women in ELT. So I will be running a session, I think, but I'll be coordinating other sessions. So this is a really big way of testing out whether or not there's a kind of wider conference in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I've been doing alongside that is set up a big Women in ELT Facebook group, which I sort of see as a massive networking thing for women in ELT. And that's got 250 members at the moment. It's growing really quickly.
Okay, so what's that called and where can you find it?
So the Facebook group is just called Women in ELT. So you can probably find it through searching Facebook, but you could also look for my blog, which if you Google Simple English Nicola Prentice, there's a post in that blog that will lead you to the website, well, to the Facebook group.
So Simple English Nicola Prentice.
Yeah.
Wow, brilliant. Okay, well, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem, thank you.
And best of luck for 2017.
Thanks.
Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the relationship between authors and teachers. Do you think teachers choose course books on the strength of an author? Or is the idea of big name authors largely confined to the world of publishing? Phil, what are your thoughts?
From speaking to my colleagues in the staff room, I think what often happens is that people will choose a course book at the beginning of their career from one of those that they've used on their Trinity or on their CELTA course, something they feel comfortable with, or maybe they'll get a recommendation from someone else in the staff room. And once they've found something that they're comfortable with, they might try other editions in the same series.
Yeah, that was definitely the case for me on the back of my CELTA. I went with that same course because it was reliable for me.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But I think teachers often choose their course books based on the classes, so different specialisms.
Yeah.
But also, if teachers want to get into materials writing, it's kind of useful to know certain authors they enjoy, because then they can base their work on that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right. Well, listeners, what do you think? Do you choose books based on the author? Let us know. Okay, let's move on to Teacher's Dilemma. Each month, we describe a common classroom issue and ask listeners to send in their solutions. Becca, what have you got for us this month?
Okay, Sam. So, a student approaches you at the end of class and explains they are applying for a job and would you mind having a look at their CV and cover email? You glance down and realise this is going to be more than a quick check. Both documents are going to need a complete overhaul. Your student needs to send it all off by the end of the week, but you're not sure you'll have time to get the job done properly. And actually, this does feel a bit beyond the call of duty. You want to help, of course, but this is a big job. What do you do?
Yeah, this is a difficult one, isn't it? Obviously, you want to help as much as possible. Mm-hmm. We're lucky where we are because we've got an academic counsellor who is one of our teachers. And mm-hmm. in the afternoon, she's got a couple of slots to talk to people who want to apply for jobs, apply for university, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So we've got a one-to-one That's service to deal with this kind of thing. But otherwise, well, you've said need to send it off by the end of the week. So maybe if other students would benefit from the same kind of thing, maybe you could teach a lesson.
That's a good idea. With uh-huh.
that. I mean, there are also course books which deal with this sort of thing, CVs, covering letters. Uh-huh. So you could give models, maybe write one of your own, if that's appropriate.
Uh-huh. You could give a homework assignment. You could give them a copy of an example of a CV and say, okay, you got till tomorrow, and then you could revise. Depends what day of the week it is. If it's on a Monday, they'd have 4 days to get their CV up to speed.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like that idea of just incorporating it into the week.
Yeah, it's a very good idea. Mm-hmm. All right, listeners, what are your thoughts? Send your solutions to this month's dilemma to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Okay, let's move on to our final section, Q&A, the part of the show in which we try to answer your questions. Is everyone ready?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, first question. Is it appropriate to teach pronunciation topics like elision, intrusion, and linking at lower levels? Phil, what do you think?
Absolutely, yes, certainly is. I wouldn't use those terms, though. I don't think that's helpful for students. But I don't think you're doing them any favours if you don't teach these things. Let's take an example. We've got three words, you and me. Okay, put them together naturally, you and me, mm-hmm. you and me. Okay, so we've got the intruding w sound, you and you've got the n instead of and me.
Yeah.
So if you demonstrate you and me, you and me, you and me, you show how unnatural that is, how difficult it is to pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And I think that reassures the students, oh, a native speaker, the teacher can't do it properly, mm-hmm. if you like, properly in inverted commas. And you show how much easier that is.
Yeah, and also, really, what's the benefit in getting students to drilling sentences and phrases for students that are unnatural, like you and me, that mm-hmm. deliberate slow pronunciation that's essentially inaccurate,
yeah,
is not helpful.
I agree. And I think pronunciation is quite a kind of fun thing to do at a lower level. At any level, yeah, it's definitely a little bit of a break from everything else.
Yeah, we actually had some interesting feedback on the website the other day saying, I don't like teaching my students gunner because low-level students saying gunner very carefully sounds stupid. Mm. And I thought that was a pretty odd comment. And I actually replied saying, I think the opposite. But yeah, I think Phil's absolutely right.
That's an interesting debate though, isn't it? That's an interesting discussion. All right, our next question is, do you ever use graded readers in class?
Okay, well, I can give you an example of an activity that we were doing last week. I've got a pre-intermediate class at the moment. And okay. We took a look at a book of short stories. They were all ghost stories. Mm-hmm. And the story that we focused on, we did a bit of prediction using the title and using the pictures that were in the book. And then they read sections of the story just mm-hmm. to check their ideas to see if they were correct. At the end of the story, we did a newspaper report based on what had happened. That worked very well. Mm. They seemed to enjoy that. And then after you read two or three stories, you can do some work on comparing the different stories, which they like more and why.
I like that idea of using short stories as well.
Yeah, I mean, personally speaking, I wasn't a huge fan of graded readers. I tended to try and use more authentic text in class and then just try and find like a shorter article or something very, very basic but authentic for lower level classes and then kind of more complicated newspaper articles for higher levels. That was my personal opinion. But yeah, I think graded readers definitely do have a place.
Okay, and finally, is there an alternative to the classic seating plan, the horseshoe?
In rooms where you've got an opportunity to move your desks around, yeah, we've got a couple of things. I think boardroom style tends to be great if you've got a smaller group of students. I tend to have no more than 10, 12 typically, so that works well. And if you want to divide your students into groups, again, you've got not too many people in a room. A kind of cluster arrangement is good. Maybe you have four people around a table, maybe three, four tables spread around the room. They can do their own work and then come together again later.
Yeah, and I'm sure it depends on the type of class that you've got, right? So for a conversation class, that kind of the classic horseshoe is a great thing to do. But in an exam class, if they've got to do lots of writing or anything like that, then maybe it's not the most appropriate.
Yeah, I think it's tricky in some classrooms. There's just not enough space anyway, right. So you just have to cram everyone in. So it's really tricky. But even if you can just get, you know, little pairs within that cram space, then that's a good thing.
True, but I think generally the point is that any kind of variety is good, isn't it? Mixing it up keeps it interesting for you and for the students.
Yeah, definitely. Mix it up.
Okay, well, that's it for another show. As always, I'd like to thank our regular panellists, Becca and Patrick.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you to our guest teacher, Phil Painter. It's been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for all your feedback. Remember, if you have any questions, suggestions or comments on anything we've talked about this month, you can email us at onestoppodcast@springernature.com or leave a post on the One Stop page. And until next month, this is the One Stop English Podcast.